Okay. On behalf of City Journal, and also of the Donald and Paula Smith Foundation, a very warm welcome to you all. Thank you so much for joining us this morning. The act of war that took place not 3 miles from here on September 11th has faced New York with a host of difficult problems. Our goal this morning is to clarify just what those problems are and to propose some very concrete solutions to them. At the outset, it's important to recognize that these problems are eminently soluble. Problem one, the attack destroyed 12 million square feet of prime office space on the World Trade Center site alone and put perhaps half again as much space out of commission in the buildings surrounding the site. What are we going to rebuild? What should it look like? How are we going to go about the rebuilding? Who will be in charge of it? Who will pay for it? Who will own it? Problem two, the economy. The nation was probably already going into recession when the planes hit, but the attacks definitively reversed the longest expansion in history. For New York, this problem has a special twist. A recession hits the financial industry that's our number one revenue generator especially hard. These circumstances only worsened the impact of September 11th on the local economy. The attack displaced some of our financial firms and drove them out of town to, we can say, let's hope, temporary quarters. It disrupted our transportation infrastructure. The loss of so much real estate, equivalent to the entire Cincinnati business district, means that when the economy does start expanding again, New York will be hard-pressed to provide the space needed for local job growth. The attack also turned New York from being a place where business and tourists wanted to be to a place they would just as soon avoid right now. With so many negatives for the economy, what can we do to minimize the damage and allow recovery to begin soon? Especially with a new mayor taking control, what policies will make things better rather than worse? And that brings us to problem three. How can we better secure the city against the threat of terrorism, so that people will not be afraid to visit here and do business here? Alongside those things Washington is doing to make the whole nation safer, waging war against the terrorists, upgrading airline security and the like, what steps can we take to increase the safety of the city itself, already targeted once and especially vulnerable because of its population density and the fact that it's composed of islands? And in particular, does the large Muslim population living in our midst constitute a threat? And if so, what protective measures should we take? Finally, thousands of our friends and neighbors died on September 11th. People from every walk of life, including the heroic firemen and cops who tried to save people in the burning Twin Towers. What would be a fitting memorial to them? We're going to divide our proceedings into three panels with a question period after each. If you'd like to ask a question, can I ask you to line up behind the microphone that will be there at the front of that aisle? And in the interest of letting as many people have a voice as possible, can I ask everybody please to keep this question concise? Now, our first two speakers will address the how and the who of rebuilding the city's economic and physical fabric. Please welcome first Stephen Malanga, a contributing editor of City Journal and a former executive editor of Crain's New York Business. If there's a journalist living who knows more about New York's economy than Steve, I haven't come upon it. He's written in City Journal about everything from the mafia to the mess in New York's healthcare system to merit pay for teachers. Steve Malanga.
Thank you, Margaret. During the Democratic mayoral runoff, a debate broke out between Fernando Ferrer and Mark Green about the most appropriate way to start the rebuilding process. And the debate was over where it should occur. Should it focus on downtown, as Mark Green argued, or should we pursue corporate dispersal, which is moving jobs to the other boroughs, which is what many people thought that companies would want to do in the aftermath of the bombing. For a week or so, this geographic debate framed the entire discussion about the rebuilding process, and it made it seem as if these were the only two choices. When I looked into both plans, what struck me was not how different they were, but rather how similar they were. Despite their disagreements over geography, both plans assumed that government should direct and manage the rebuilding, down to deciding what was to go where and how it would be done. On the other hand, to me, the real debate should have been not where, but how was the city going to institute this rebuilding? Were we going to let a Green administration, a Ferrer administration, or any administration decide the crucial questions, or was the market going to be allowed to decide that? Now, to me, it wasn't surprising that the candidates in a Democratic primary in New York City were having this kind of a debate. New York's approach to economic development and to economic revitalization has usually been based on this kind of a model, which Myron loves to refer to as state capitalism. Now, what is state capitalism? Well, briefly stated, it lets government decide how to create the master plan for what to erect. It creates a public entity to micromanage the entire process, ensuring that important decisions like the selection of developers gets completely politicized. It lets government have a continuing role once the project has been built in managing the project, usually through public authorities, which are the source of lots of jobs and patronage. Now, this approach has led to one failure after another in New York over the years, and I think those failures were actually magnified after September 11th. You remember, as Myron pointed out, that immediately after September 11th, a number of prominent companies quickly signed deals to go elsewhere outside of New York City. Now, why did they do this, particularly in New Jersey? Well, they didn't do it principally because they were afraid to be in Manhattan, and they didn't do it principally because of high costs. They did it because that's where the space was. That's where the building has been going on. The fact of the matter is, for a generation or so, at least in New Jersey, they've done far more commercial building close to New York City than New York has been able to do anywhere except in its basic midtown office districts. This is something that New York has never really addressed adequately, except through government programs like incentive programs. And New York really needs to understand this vulnerability, because it's really been more acute after September 11th. The city has a difficult task ahead of it, replacing the office space lost in the bombing. And it needs to use that opportunity not simply to reconstruct portions of downtown, but to reinvigorate the entire development process in New York. Even before city and state officials can turn their attention downtown, it's going to take a while, obviously, for the cleanup and for some of the legal issues and so forth, the infrastructure issues. The city and state have to really instill a new sense of urgency into the land use process in New York City. And they really have to focus on desperately needed development in opportune new districts like Manhattan's Far West Side or along the Queens and Brooklyn waterfront. To understand how the process has to be reformed and what can be accomplished, it's only necessary to look at two industrial waterfronts, former industrial waterfronts, the Queens-Brooklyn waterfront on one hand and Jersey along the Hudson on the other. Nothing illustrates the problems with New York's development process more clearly than one 74-acre site in Queens called Queens West, which has been a joint project of three government agencies begun in 1983. While developers in Jersey have built staggering amounts of office space, most of it being filled by former New York companies along the Jersey waterfront, 17 years have passed since the start of Queens West, and there government has managed to erect one tower, missing not one, but two enormous real estate booms in New York City. Finally, in the last couple of years, the project has begun to move. Developers have been assigned. Another tower is being built, but this is 17 years later. Every part of Queens West has been micromanaged by the government, from the master plan down to the way the board was constructed, to the fact that each and every site had to be built by a different developer in a very politicized process. Now, compare this to what happened in just one place in Jersey City, called Newport City, where a disgruntled New York developer, Sam Leprak, went in 1983, just as Queens West was being planned. After negotiating with the Jersey officials over what they wanted him to do and what he wanted to do, Leprak got the okay to build when the market was right. He began in the late 80s, stopped for a while, and started again. Today, I believe, Newport City has 9 apartment towers, 6 office towers, a marina, a mall, a health club, a helipad. Just imagine if Newport was on the Queens waterfront instead of the Jersey waterfront. There isn't any reason that it couldn't be, except for government. Rather than the traditional New York approach, the proper role of government has to be to set up the conditions that allow development to take place in opportune districts like the far west side of Manhattan or the industrial waterfront. Because when the economy begins recovering, even though companies will be willing to go to downtown Manhattan, and I'll say more about that, this is where the opportunity exists in what we've taken to call in the Opportunity City, the new New York. I think that Joe Rose sort of demonstrated this on the far west side. Even before September 11th, he began talking about the process of how you would encourage development there because of the tremendous need that there was for additional office space. Joe didn't propose a commission, a public authority, a government agency. He said instead, we need to rezone so that builders can go there if they want to and build there if the market asks them to. And government's role is not only to change the antiquated zoning process, but to encourage the kind of infrastructure development that would help that along. But that's all that government's role is. Now, there are people who would say to me, when I suggest this approach, that New York government shouldn't be encouraging any kind of building at a time like this. What I would say to that, first of all, is, again, I'm not advocating government building or government-sponsored development, but rather for government to set up what is necessary to allow new buildings to take place in New York and to let the private sector decide if it wants to build, if New York, in effect, is still a good investment. The problem with government, when it controls the process, is that it usually decides just about the time the market has returned, and by the time the building is ready to begin, of course, we've missed the opportunity for the marketplace. I would add that I think that what happened on September 11th has not changed the fact that New York is manifestly a very good investment. If not right now, certainly sometime very soon in the future. After 7 years of really fabulous growth that's reshaped the city's economy, the fundamentals are in place for New York to recover and resume its economic growth at some point in the very near future. Reforming the building process would be an important prelude to the task of redeveloping downtown. The opportunity exists to reimagine that area, not only as a memorial to those who died, but also as a symbol of the new city and the new economy that was emerging in the mid-1990s. The old towers, which were built on this 12-block footprint that eliminated the through streets and substituted this enormous, imposing plaza that was almost entirely blocked to pedestrians, was really out of step with the new downtown, which had been emerging. A diversified 24-hour downtown neighborhood where offices sat side by side with residents. Something different is called for now than the old World Trade Center, something that reflects the changing nature of lower Manhattan, and I would say of Manhattan in general, and something that helps to connect that area to the various diverse neighborhoods which were springing up downtown. One clear way of achieving this is by abandoning the notion of this giant imposing plaza and instead recreating the neighborhood down there, reinstituting the neighborhood, the street grid. Reestablishing the city blocks would provide enormous flexibility, allowing developers to construct a series of different buildings, all of different uses, in that area. In addition, the shops, the restaurants, the stores that were encased in this plaza and inaccessible would be brought out to street level moving people through the neighborhood, recreating a neighborhood itself. This is something that the architects who are here will have much more to say about later, so I'm just going to move on. They're going to show you how it can be done and what it can look like. Now, what to design is only one issue. How to go about the rebuilding process is equally important, because the potential for political gridlock down there, I think, is enormous when you consider all the parties which will have an interest in the rebuilding. First of all, it's obvious, I think, after what I've said, that you would assume, I think, the government needs to avoid the kind of state capitalism approach that New York has tried so many times before, where government functionaries will play a substantial and continuing role through some kind of commission or authority that manages downtown from here on. And don't think that some people aren't thinking of doing that. There are some issues that government is going to have to decide, especially when you consider the nature of what happened downtown. One of the things, of course, is going to be what role, if any, the Port Authority should continue to play in the site. Given the Port Authority's rather dreadful record on real estate, and also the fact that, given the fact that Governor Pataki's appointees to the Port Authority have urged and been pushing the agency out of real estate development for the last couple of years, that's a process that I think Governor Pataki should be applauded for and should continue, because right now, among other things, the Port Authority has its hands full managing the region's airports and the security there, as well as its bridges and tunnels. There's also the far more complicated question of what role the developer who was leasing and managing the Twin Towers, Larry Silverstein, should have. Given that federal, state, and city governments are contributing billions, far more than what he could possibly afford to clean up the site, one can argue that the entire 16 acres shouldn't just, once it's been reconstituted and cleaned up, be given back to him to do whatever he wants to do on that site. There are all kinds of public policy decisions that need to be made and that are the proper role for government, including what's going to be done with the transportation infrastructure down there, and what is done will really guide the success of the redevelopment of Lower Manhattan. Also, questions about the street grid, should it be reconstituted, can it, and how, are things that city planning are going to have to need to look at and decide. In addition to this, let's face it, the extraordinary amount of role that the federal money that the federal government is pouring into this means that the federal government is going to want at least some say in how this money is spent. The governor has already set up a commission to oversee what happens downtown. One hopes this commission comes to be composed of a small group of sensible private sector people who would select a team of developers, perhaps including Larry Silverstein as part of that, to carry out the entire process of rebuilding downtown. One hopes the commission doesn't become some kind of self-perpetuating government entity that manages every facet of the building process and that keeps itself alive for years after that process has been finished. In the few minutes that I have left, I'd like to say a few things about the broader economic issues and the fiscal issues the city faces. Now, there just isn't enough time for me to go into detail about some of these things, and they are in the article that I wrote, but I want to very quickly give you what I think is a principle that we should all keep in mind and that should guide our thinking going forward. In the days after the mayor's election, a headline in the Wall Street Journal described the mayor-elect as a good man facing an impossible job. The TV commentator George Stephanopoulos said that Bloomberg had just won the toughest job in America. Now, I think such ideas are not only wrong, they're dangerous. They resurrect the notion, which is always floating somewhere near the surface in New York, that New York City is basically an ungovernable city, subject mostly to forces outside its own control, where the actions of its leaders matter only on the margin. The biggest achievement of the Giuliani administration was to demonstrate again, as Mayor Koch did in the late 1970s, that New York is a governable city, where the decisions of its civic leaders are crucial. While the task facing Bloomberg is enormous, we shouldn't overestimate it, because it could lead to civic paralysis or a sense that the city can't help itself, only Washington or Albany can bail itself out. It's worth remembering that Bloomberg will probably face a budget deficit no larger than the one that Mayor Giuliani faced in his first year in office. That the economy, even now with the steep slowdown, is in far better shape than the economy was in 1994, when there was no discernible engine of growth anywhere on the horizon. That the city's thorniest problem, high crime, which many people thought was a completely intractable problem, has been solved spectacularly. By keeping these things in mind, one will remember that the solutions to the city's current problems don't involve magic bullets or panicky policies like raising taxes in the middle of a recession, which is already being advocated. Instead, the solutions actually are out there, and they involve consistent and persistent application of the kinds of sensible ideas that have served the city well during other difficult periods, and that we know the answers to. It's true that Bloomberg will face a literal hole downtown, a figurative hole in his budget, and an uncertain economic future. But he's also going to command the nation's best police force. He's going to provide over a city with the richest and most diverse cultural fabric of any in the world. And he's going to have to be supported by a business community, which is probably the most powerful in the world. Instead of being worried, I'm more worried that the guy will be overconfident. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Steve. New York has a wealth of examples of state capitalist projects that haven't worked out well. Here to tell you about just one such example, the original World Trade Center project, is City Journal senior editor Brian Anderson. Brian's City Journal stories have covered matters as diverse as pit bulls and homeschooling. And as a political science PhD, he has also found time to write a book about French political thinker Raymond Aron. Brian Anderson.
Thank you, Mark. What I have to say is an amplification of Steve's argument, so I'll be brief and we can open the floor to questions. The terrorists who attacked New York on September 11 targeted the World Trade Center as a symbol of American capitalism. But in fact, from the moment it opened its doors in the early 1970s, the centers, owned and operated by the publicly funded Port Authority of New York and New Jersey, was really a monument to the ills of state capitalism, where government substitutes its bureaucratic and politically motivated thinking for the wisdom of the free market's invisible hand. This economic development philosophy, in which government officials act as all-knowing capitalists, has dominated New York's economic life for decades. It doesn't work. As New York officials set up a new public entity to oversee the rebuilding of Lower Manhattan, the center's history provides a cautionary tale for everyone involved. Virtually every important consideration in developing the World Trade Center would have nothing to do with business and everything to do with politics. The Twin Towers were first conceived in the late 1950s as a group of businessmen led by Governor Nelson Rockefeller's brother David, CEO of Chase Manhattan Bank, sought a political means of pumping economic life into a lower Manhattan that had steadily declined since the Depression. A government-created office complex, they felt, would attract tenants from the world of global trade to replace the financial firms that had left downtown, and so spur new economic development throughout the area and boost its struggling ports. Enlisting the governor's help, the group turned to the Port Authority, which could float bonds and whose board was under his control, to own, develop, and manage the property. The Port Authority was eager to expand its reach beyond its traditional lucrative role of managing the area's ports, bridges, and tunnels. Now it could get into the real estate business. Why was this a bad idea? First, since the World Trade Center originated as government's idea of what Lower Manhattan needed, rather than as what the market really called for, it's no surprise it misfired commercially and never came close to justifying a billion-dollar-plus cost, a cost that quickly often filled government-run economic projects, all initial estimates. Indeed, when the Trade Center's initial 10 million square feet of office space first hit the market in the early 1970s, the result was such an office glut that Lower Manhattan real estate values sank at a time when the city was struggling. Rather than drawing new firms to Gotham, as its planners thought it would, It subsidized rents well below market rates, drew in tenants from other lower Manhattan offices, driving up the
How much do you
know? Howard Spillett built the New York State building all its city offices into the building, becoming the country's biggest tenant until in the 80s when the state moved out. Despite its dramatic commercial failure, Port Authority bureaucrats long saw the complex through this collection of economic development projects on both sides of the Hudson. Building it, as is true of all state capitalist projects, was a patronage bonanza. Name of the contract for architects and engineers to consult every stride. Thereafter, reviewing the thousands of contracts, work orders, and leases that the buildings issued every year, required an army of authority accountants, engineers, and lawyers, another patronage bonanza. And what bureaucrat would want to relinquish the power of awarding the ongoing maintenance and concessions contracts? But such deal-making, with the public footing the bill, and this is the second big problem, with state capitalists, guarantees inefficiency, since there's no free market in place that by rewarding good work and disciplining bad would pressure administrators to hire the right people for the right jobs and make sure they worked hard. Worse, the inefficiency often slides toward outright corruption. Within a decade of the Twin Towers opening, criminal investigators were accusing authority officials of retroactively altering expense vouchers, insider bidding deals on service contracts, massive abuse of the agency's fleet of vehicles, and lavish junkets for top agency officials. Nearly three decades after the World Trade Center opened, after years of pressure to privatize this white elephant, the Port Authority, stopping short of selling it, instead leased it with tax exemptions and other government perks still attached to developer Larry Silverstein for $3.2 billion over 99 years. This was a good deal for the developer, but not for New York City and its taxpayers. Ultimately, those taxpayers would pay a bigger percentage of the city's tax burden than if the Trade Center had paid its fair share. The World Trade Center represented the most direct and least defensible form of state capitalism, where government builds, owns, and runs developments itself. Other kinds include so-called public-private partnerships, or when politicians dole out tax cuts for specific corporations to keep them from leaving the city or to attract them here in the first place, as opposed to pushing for across-the-board reductions that all businesses would benefit from. But all such government-run economic development projects, undisciplined by the market, tend to make unwise investments while competing unfairly with the private sector and are subject to both inefficiency and corruption. If all the money lavished on state capitalist projects simply stayed in taxpayers' hands, they would invest it in unanticipated and creative ways. History shows that the money individuals and businesses invest and spend, if left alone to do so, generates far more wealth and new jobs than government-directed spending. The most successful states and cities dedicate their resources to creating the conditions that attract private investment on its own terms. In rebuilding Lower Manhattan, New York shouldn't make the same mistake it made in building the World Trade Center in the first place. Government should restrict itself to facilitating the cleanup of Ground Zero and rebuilding and improving the area's infrastructure. And then, as Steve has just argued, it should get out of the way and let the market do its work. Thank you.
We have time for questions, and anybody who would like to ask one is warmly invited to step up to the microphone and ask it. Amity, ladies are first, of course.
Amity Schlink, Financial Times. I'm wondering, I was trying to think of some analogies from other countries where they had faced similar challenges, and the one that came to mind was Eastern Germany. West Germany had a choice at that time. They could have declared East Germany a tax-free zone, as the Liberal Party in fact advocated, or they could do state capitalism. And basically they chose the latter, the result being that East Germany is still dogged with high unemployment, former Communist Party leaders are politically popular. Can you think of some other examples that you had in mind when you were writing it, or that are important to bear in mind?
Well, I think the
the record of these kind of state capitalist projects across the globe that's been pretty lousy. So we need to do is compare the job creation of European social democracies
with the U.S. over the last 30 years. I can't think of a comparable catastrophe to this, since there hasn't been any in recent years. Anyway,
you can think of the Javits Center.
There's certainly plenty of such examples right here in New York.
You don't have to go overseas, Javits. Bill.
Bill Tucker, I'm going to disagree with a little bit of this. One explanation, I think, of why the government has to participate so much in real estate deals in New York is that the zoning, planning, land use regulations are so insurmountable that only government itself can get over them. So basically that's why the government always has to be a senior partner.
It's like the joke of the person who kills his parents and then claims mercy for being an orphan, right?
Yeah, exactly. So that's another thing. But let me just ask Steve. How do you reconcile, you want the market to make decisions, but how do you reconcile eliminating Larry Silverstein from this almost immediately? I mean, he is a private developer who has plunked down his $1 billion, whatever it was, and in effect, he has a lease to that property. He ought to be able to do what he wants with it. Why are you saying, well, we shouldn't allow him to do it because, you know, my plan for reintegrating the streets is a better plan?
Well, I would say a couple of things. First of all, you say he owns it. This is a 99-year lease of the sort that they're relatively young if you think of the fact that no 99-year lease has ever come to term. We've never had one of these 99-year
leases
in New York. We've never had a case where a building was destroyed on the site. He had the right to manage those buildings. Plus we have an act of war. We have the government spending what will be upwards of $20 billion on that particular site. So given all of that...
And he himself has said he hasn't got the $8 billion that it will take to rebuild.
So government said, well, what is our obligation? Is our obligation to spend $20 billion so that you, who had the lease to these buildings, should immediately have the right to do whatever you want, including just re-put up those particular buildings? I think that this is not a very simple case of this is the government taking property rights away from someone. And, of course, Silverstein should and is be indemnified for the lease, although it's the Port Authority at this point, which really needs to be paid off. Silverstein paid little into the lease, except for his fairly large down payment.
But covered by insurance.
Right, but remember, this is $20 billion the government is spending to clean up what was an act of war. Do you think that after spending $20 billion that then all public policy decisions should be handed over to an individual who had the lease on the property?
Isn't this the argument the government always uses? We put in this much money now, we should...
Well, Larry Silverstein will be paid by his insurers, so he will end up coming out whole. That's thing one. But the other question you asked is, well, how can you suggest keeping government out in a real estate regime where the barriers to building are so insurmountable that nothing can get built without a fixer in government? And you are 100% correct about this. And Steve deals with it in his story, and he says this is a wonderful time, given our crisis, to reassess the way we do real estate in this city. And certainly, whatever happens downtown, let's be darn sure that these barriers are just swept away so that something like an actual free market can operate there. But Steve goes on to say that, you can consider that we have this opportunity to free, in effect, the entire West Side from the bottom up to Columbus Circle, where the new Time Warner headquarters are rising, to exuberant free market development. So you're absolutely right that what we should be pressing for is not to say, oh, what can we do? We have this terrible regime. What we should be saying is, let's get rid of it. It's a political creation. And just as Rudy Giuliani showed that with political will, you can make big changes, you could make big changes with this, too.
Okay, thank you.
Mary Campbell Gallagher. One aside, and that is that one reason people want to involve the government is that it has eminent domain, so that the developers need not pay full dollar for the properties, but free market can start to operate once they take title, which is a charmed way to do business. But the question I was going to ask, rather, was this one, and it's that all of your discussion assumes the monoculture of Wall Street.
Assumes the what?
The monoculture of the so-called fire industries, finance, insurance, real estate, that Mr. Magnet said, well, we're dependent on this, and indeed we are. When I came here 50 years ago, 45 years ago, there was a vibrant port. There were dozens of manufacturing industries. There were lots of different kinds of industries. As Pete Hamill said, we went from 1 million people in manufacturing and 300,000 on welfare to 1 million on welfare. Maybe now it's 500,000. Maybe it's some number in between, and 300,000 or 250,000 in manufacturing. But in any event, all of this discussion seems to take it for granted that when the Port Authority traded support of the PATH trains for destruction of the Lower Manhattan port, we got an irreversible good deal. And I think that's a question, and I would welcome your observations on it.
Well, a couple of things. I'm not sure what you mean by the mono
culture
of Wall Street, because for one thing, the downtown, as I said, was changing dramatically. I didn't get into the economics of it, but downtown was no longer a bastion of Wall Street by any means, and it is not going to be Wall Street that is going to revive downtown. In fact, the irony, again, is that the World Trade Center, in which two-thirds of the firms were financial services, was the only place left downtown of any substance other than the Goldman Sachs building and, of course, the New York Stock Exchange. But it was downtown is not going to be revived by the financial industry. That's number one. The issue, I'm not quite sure the question about the issue of the ports.
Talk about the new jobs.
And manufacturing. I would agree with you that Port Authority has mismanaged the port. That's part of the fact that it's been distracted from its primary role. As for manufacturing, however, I mean, it's very glib to say we've traded 1 million manufacturing jobs for, you know, 1 million people on welfare, but so did virtually every other city in America, and I think that is a global phenomenon. You could point to a number of individual things that New York government did, including its high electricity taxes, but in general, I don't think that manufacturing is going to be the spur to the economy of any city in America anytime soon again. I'm not sure that's quite a, you know, that's...
Well, with due deference, the rate of decline in New York has been far higher than any place else. The rate of decline nationwide is we're down to something like 7% manufacturing jobs.
Yes.
And in New York, it's more like...
And don't you think that's because we have higher costs and also because our primary industry here, our primary manufacturing industry was apparel, which has shrunk the most because of jobs overseas?
Well,
I mean, that's...
Let me confess immediately that I'm over my depth as far as industrial economics is concerned. So I'll leave that as a question. However, whatever the other industries are that might profitably exist here and absorb some of our graduating students who may not ace the regions, whatever industries we're looking for, they can't all be office jobs. And a great deal of this has talked as though they were office jobs, and that's okay.
Can I just say one thing here? It's one of the things that Steve talks about in his story is that it's often missed what an economic miracle we had in New York over the last 5 or 6 years. And we created how many new jobs?
450,000.
450,000 new jobs, more than at any other time in our history. And these jobs were not in fire, not predominantly in fire. They were in the various new technological industries that are based on New York's being this great. So it's a bubble has burst. You're quite right. But this industry is not dead. It will certainly come back, and it will certainly prosper. It is true, however, that the jobs in those industries are not predominantly going to be able to hire the uneducated graduates of our city high schools. And that is a very different problem, which is beyond our scope to discuss this morning. But there's been tremendous job creation here, which has diversified our economy. And no one would want to trade jobs in a well-paying high-tech industry, which is the future, though temporarily depressed, to get back all those triangle shirtwaist jobs, I think. Dick Netzer?
Dick Netzer, NYU. This is, I guess, addressed to Steve and I. I think with all the destruction of the first-class office space in Lower Manhattan, there obviously was, two minutes after it happened, some real demand for replacement office space by firms that had chosen to locate in Manhattan, would just as soon locate in Manhattan. I mean, that's a reasonable assumption. And they're dispersed to various places and various things have happened. But it strikes me that rebuilding sooner rather than later is important, because if it takes many years before anything is done, because we have to wait for the perfect plan from the architects and the state capitalists and all that, that we will that the demand will not be for space in Manhattan. It is true that zoning, etc., makes it very difficult for private parties to move ahead. But we do have a lot of space in Manhattan where the zoning is reasonably consistent with ordinary, plain vanilla, 30-story or so office buildings, which developers surely know how to build and build quickly. You know how to assemble the lots and so on. So, wouldn't you expect that the market would be the market response?
And actually I didn't get to this in my talk because it was very limited, but it is in the story. I mean, it's so practical and obvious that it shouldn't even be a point of debate. And I believe that the city is trying to do this. There are about 12 or 13 developable plots in Manhattan in which people were people had projects. Now, these projects can go forward and should go forward. However, you're right that the zoning is such that plain vanilla development can sort of take place. The fact of the matter is there's no such thing as completely plain, and that all of these projects still have to go through the zoning process. In the story I talk about, and other people talk about, fast-tracking it to get these 12 or 13 buildings built. That includes all sorts of things. The city planning should even be outsourcing the process right now. The city can do that in order to get these plans approved. I agree with you 100%, and that's sort of so sensible. One hopes it's taking place, and I think it is taking place. There have been talks of a number of these individual sites, and you're absolutely right, and I do allude to that, and that's probably the first and most practical thing that should be done.
Well, it's very, very gratifying to hear that it is taking place.
My job is to keep the trains running on time here and to show that the city is governable. We have 1 minute left for questions. You've got 30 seconds to ask, 30 seconds to answer.
Jennifer Bennett, Columbia University. I guess the crisis that we have here before us with the World Trade Center coming apart, being destroyed, is also pointing to other issues that we've been ignoring in the city, such as transportation. And we are at a point of saturation with vehicular traffic. And one of the reasons why it would be good to have the government, I understand your argument about private interests, is to have them develop a comprehensive plan that will work on some of those issues. And how can we trust the private developers to work on some of the more
comprehensive issues? I think we can give that a 30-second answer.
Yeah, I mean, and I've said this in the speech, that is the role, when I talk about what the role of government is, one of the roles of government certainly is transportation and infrastructure. And the only large question now is we don't have the money. Right now, the city, for some of these projects, the city didn't have the money before, and the question is where it will come from. And it is possible to have a reasonable discussion about whether federal transportation money might be used. The problem is that the plans that Albany has put forth for federal transportation money, in light of what happened, includes things like high-speed rail access to Schenectady, New York, and as a result, those kinds of things get dismissed right away because they're seen as pork barreling. So I agree with you. That is a role of government, absolutely.
And you will. How can the private developers work with?
We need to break off here. But thank you very much, and we need to begin our next panel. Forgive me, sir, but I have my colleagues in the back saying, move it along. Thank you both very much, and thank all the questions.